You know, when it comes to wireless carriers, sometimes what you see isn't always what you get, except with Visible. With Visible, what you see is exactly what you get. If you haven't heard of Visible, well, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. With Visible, there are no hidden fees, no fine print, no hassle, nothing to hide. It's just $25 a month, all taxes and fees included. And you don't need more than one line of wireless to save. You can save on a line all to yourself with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. And again, just $25 a month. The future of wireless is here, and it is transparent. If you want more transparency in your wireless plan, you want to be on the Visible plan. Switch to Visible today and save at Visible.com. That's Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com. This episode of GameScoop is sponsored by Squarespace. If you're looking for a way to make your business stand out and succeed online, Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for you. They take the stress out of creating an awesome website, engaging with your audience, and selling anything from products to content to time, so you're able to focus on, you know, everything else. In other words, you'll have more time for gaming. With the new guided design system, you can choose from curated layouts and styling options to build a unique online presence from the ground up, optimized for every device. And with Squarespace's integrated, optimized SEO tools, you'll show up more often to more people. Squarespace doesn't just make things easier for you. Checkout for your customers is made seamless with simple but powerful payment tools that allow you to accept credit cards, PayPal, and Apple Pay, and in eligible countries, offer the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and Clearpay. So whether you're just starting out or looking to expand your existing brand, be sure to visit squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/gamescoop to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com/gamescoop for 10% off. What's up, everybody? Welcome to IGN GameScoop. I'm your host, Damon Hatfield. Joining me this week are Tina Amini.
Hi, everybody.
Sam Claiborne.
Hey, hey.
And Justin Davis.
Scoop.
We've got a great show for you this week. We've got that new, all new PlayStation Plus to discuss. The long, it had been rumored for quite a while as Project Spartacus. It was confirmed this week. We'll talk about the delay of Breath of the Wild 2, which is a game, obviously, many on the show are looking forward to and gets discussed and brought up very often from time to time. But first, I would like to tell you all a story, if you will allow it.
Yes, please.
So I finished Horizon Forbidden West. Loved it. Yep, loved it. Thank you. And played for a very long time. But by the time I finished it, I felt like I was done with it. So then came time to decide what to play next. And I've, of course, have Tunic that I've started and quite like a lot. But in the back of my mind, I was still thinking about Elden Ring. So I was like, what the heck? I'll jump back into some Elden Ring. Where I had left off, I'd beaten Margit, and I was in Stormveil Castle and on my way to Godrick, which is like real first boss of the game. So I played through all of Stormveil Castle. I used IGN's guide and just followed along every step of the way. And I made it to Godrick and I beat him on my second try.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, okay, that feels good. Like that feels like a normal video game boss fight. You try him a couple times and then you beat him. So I was like, cool. That was fun. I had fun. I'm having fun. I'll keep playing this. But this game session is done. So I'm going to stop playing for now and play later. Uh-oh, my controller is almost out of batteries. I'll connect it with the USB cable and I'll put my PlayStation 5 into rest mode. And instead of going into rest mode, it just crashed. And then when I turned it back on again, it went into safe mode. But I don't know if you've ever seen safe mode on a PS5. There's seven options.
Janky.
It's only seven options. And only the seventh option, the nuclear option, was available, which is to restore your PS5 to factory settings.
Whoa.
Didn't want to do that. You lose everything on your PS5.
Your hard drive, like your saves. No, I guess you'd have cloud if you need.
Well, you do have your cloud saves, but anything that wasn't saved, like my Elden Ring save that I had just made 2 minutes ago, beating Godrick.
Aww.
Anyway, I searched all over the internet for some sort of solution that didn't involve me restoring my PlayStation 5 to its factory settings. I could not. Other people have had the same issue. Apparently, there's no other way. So
I did it. I restored my PlayStation 5 to its factory settings. You have to download an install file to a USB, put it in your PlayStation 5, and it just resets it like you just bought it brand new.
I didn't realize there was that extra step too.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't just do it on, because there's no, you can wipe it, but then there's nothing on it. You have to get the actual, like the latest firmware from PlayStation.com. So I have to re-download all my games. That's not that big a deal. But yeah, the first thing I did was download Elden Ring. And my most recent save was from like 3 weeks ago before I made progress.
Whoa. So it hasn't synced to the cloud at all.
I mean, it's not like syncing constantly. Yeah. You know, there's a set interludes that it uploads to the cloud.
I mean, maybe that's settable. Maybe I need to look into that now. Wait, do you think it was the USB that set off the crash?
No, this is a known issue for some people with PlayStation 5. And in fact, my PS5 has crashed before trying to put it into rest mode. But before, when I turn it back on, it would just give me that scolding, like I didn't turn it off promptly, and then it would be fine.
Yeah.
This time, what do you think the issue was? And what are people online reporting? Like the issues that they're confronting the same?
It's putting it into rest mode. It is technically still not advisable to put your PlayStation 5 into rest mode.
Oh. So quit out.
I save, do that every quit. Night.
Me too. Yeah. I've never not say, done
I know.
That.
I would say every fifth time I turn on my PS5, it's like, you didn't shut me down correctly. And it's very angry with me. And I'm like, I don't know. The same thing I always do.
Yeah. The same here. I always put it in rest mode and pretty regularly it tells me I didn't shut down the proper way. I assume it's maybe when I'm switching between like my Xbox HDMI input. I don't know why that would be, but.
So anyway,
I like rest mode theoretically.
I did lose all that good progress I made. But here's the thing. I did it again. And I got back to Godric and I beat him again.
How many tries? First try?
It was three
first
times.
New try?
Three times the second time. The second time, it took me three times. And the second time, I didn't use the IGN guide at all. I just made my way through the castle. And the IGN guide is very thorough. It'll have you pick up every item in the castle. But not every item you find in Elden Ring is relevant to your build, I think.
Right. You're never going to be able to use.
So it was actually much faster the second time around. And what's cool about Elden Ring is this is a known thing. This isn't some revelation. This is just something that I'm discovering. It's like I could find different paths. Like there's like a route that's you're supposed to go past some annoying enemies, but I'm up on a balcony and I see there's like a roof below me. And Elden Ring is really forgiving with how far it lets you fall.
Walk off the edge.
Yeah, so I could just jump on a roof and like totally get around those annoying enemies. And even if the developers fully expected players to discover that, it's still a cool moment. It feels like you feel like you're putting one over on the game. Mm-hmm. And then so I beat Godric again, and I'm still playing it. Now I'm like in the Liurnia of the Lakes region, and I've gone all through the Academy of Raya, I think it's pronounced, and I'm at that boss. And I actually just tried that boss once for the first time before this show. But I did the coolest thing, you guys. I did the coolest, one of the coolest things I've done in a video game for a long time. So I hope this isn't spoilers. I don't think bosses are spoilers. I never will, because when I grew up, EGM posted pictures of every single boss in a video game long before I played. Bosses are not spoilers to me. To get to the boss of the academy, you have to run up this gauntlet, this long path where giant boulders are dropped down towards you. There's a a portal that's just dropping giant boulders. And it kind of like winds from side to side, so you can avoid it, but you have to be paying attention. You have to go through all that. And then there's a knight sort of guarding the lift to the boss. So there's like a mini boss right before the boss. And this knight is very difficult. It's a carrion knight. He kept one-shotting me. He was just killing me with one hit. But what I figured out you could do is when I get to the top of that gauntlet with the boulders, I go into like this hallway and the knight's at the end of the hallway. I could shoot him with an arrow and aggro him, get him to chase me. Mm-hmm. And then I would go back outside where the boulders are. And the knight isn't completely stupid. He knows the boulders were there, so he didn't want to come out of the door. But I could like dodge the boulders and chip away at him with my arrows. That's one way to do it. But it was taking a very long time. And what I figured out is you can annoy him to the point where he'll get careless. And he will chase you out, and you run straight out, and a boulder falls right on top of him and crushes him. And it was so
I love cool. that. I love that. I really wonder what like his AI programming is behind the scenes. If there's actually a like gets so annoyed in blind rage comes after you, like in a berserker mode or something.
Yeah,
Yeah. So anyway,
this is incredible.
The point of this whole story.
It's a real twist, Damon.
I know.
Yeah.
Listen, everybody. I'm Damon. My name is Damon Hatfield, and I love Elden Ring. I'm gonna keep playing it. I don't know. I'm a convert. Consider me a convert.
Real mature.
Seriously. So what shifted it for you, Damon? What was like the turning point? Aside from it completely wiping your PS5, which was
clearly your favorite part
experience.
That was my favorite part. Maybe just coming to terms with what the game is and like figuring out how to play it. And like, it's so cool that there aren't many games, the scenario that I just described, there aren't many games with that level of flexibility of how you can approach a conflict. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's really cool. I don't know. There's still some annoyances. I have an awesome katana now that I can't use, or at least I'm not supposed to use because I'm not at a high enough level of intelligence, which is very fitting.
That's so stupid.
I'll probably do some more grinding at some point, try to get my intelligence up because I want to use this awesome new katana. But I don't know. I really like the game now. And that's what I'm playing now instead of Tunic.
I think that makes a lot of sense because even if like the majority of what you had played before, you had this turning point in your opinion shift, like a lot of game intros are really slow because they're tutorials, they're meant to be. So you kind of don't really get the full experience until you start building up and you start to flesh out all the different things that you can do and the weapons that you can equip, and certainly makes it a little bit more like the core of the experience that you can judge it on.
Yeah.
And playing along to a guide seems like it's a fun part of this too, which is really cool. I actually like games where I'm just like, you know what, I'm just going to play along to this when it gets hard.
Yeah. I'm not using it as a total crutch though. Like I only use the guide very sparingly in the academy. If I like just got lost and didn't know where to go.
Right.
Anyway, that's my little story. Sam, you 100%ed Tunic?
Well, I did. I didn't get all the achievos. Because there's one secret achievement, which is like a sequence break, which I might still go for.
What do you mean a sequence?
Why not?
Sequence break.
It's like a crazy sequence break. It's like beating a late game boss, you know, without the first weapon. It's like crazy.
Interesting.
I wouldn't have, you know, there's nothing indicating in the game that you'd be able to do this or, you know, I looked up like a guide for it and I was like, oh, so this is how you do it. This sounds annoying. So might not do that, but I did get all of the in-game things. There's a puzzle that nobody's solved yet. When you collect at the end of the game, there's two collectible sets, and when you collect one of this 20 collectible set and one of this 12 collectible set, they do different things. And then I guess you can call the manual a collectible set too, which is like you know there's like an actual twist to the game if you get the full book, and it's so clever. It is really cool and changes how you finish the game in an amazing way. But then after that, the last couple pages you unlock, and this is you could consider this a spoiler. So maybe like skip the next 30 seconds if you don't know what's in the manual, but it's what's in every manual. Let me just say that the last couple pages are a memo section. So there's a kid's writing in it, or you know, somebody's writing a little cartoons and stuff and like puzzle solution attempts. Right. And in that, it's like all these like clues, and like I'm like some like by the end of the game, like, oh, I understand a lot of this. And then it actually led me to a bunch of the collectibles, so I didn't need to use a guide for them, which is really, really cool. And I like felt like a badass because I was looking at like basically a treasure, like a pirate's treasure map, you know, and then going back to the game and doing like in-game things based on very little information, and then compositing like this page's writing that's referencing another page's map. Like, it's insane. Like, it's really, really cool. And you can figure it all out, probably. There's some things that are just really difficult. But then you unlock all that, and you, like, you know, you unlock an area that has, like, a total mystery. And there's, like, discussions right now about what to do there. And they're, like, really, you know, they're like, not the regular type of puzzle solving that you learn how to do. There's all these different puzzles you didn't know from the very beginning of the game you could have solved, but you just didn't know until you had to figure them out later, which I've talked about before. Anyway. There's an ongoing mystery, so that's cool. But yes, did get all the collectibles. I finished the game in the certain way that you're supposed to finish it in, and et cetera, et cetera. And I just can't recommend it enough. I think it's my favorite game I've played this year for sure, easily.
Very cool. Yeah, I was just going to ask that. And then, of course, next week will be the first episode of April, which means it's time to start Game of the Year Watch 2022. Mm-hmm. So please be excited for that. And let's see, Tina, I believe you're playing Tiny Tina's Wonderlands.
Yeah, it was sort of by obligation, right? You know, Tiny Tina's got to stick together. No, as you know, I'm a big Borderlands fan. I kind of fell off at 3 because it felt a little too samey to me. And to me, Borderlands is very much a multiplayer experience too. And I just never, you know, got a chance to sync up with people to really test it out on that level. So I kind of just, you know, gravitated towards a couple other games. I didn't mind too much about keeping up with three. But now that Tiny Tina came out, I wanted to see, is this small twist of having an overworld and then the narrative being based on this like role-playing experience with a board game and with characters that are kind of narrating the more like first person in-game within the in-game stuff, like if that would be enough of a twist. And I think it is. In a lot of ways, it's still a Borderlands game. It's going to feel super familiar, but I feel like enough changed in that structure to feel fresh enough to me. Like the writing is still often sophomoric, so also very Borderlands-y, but it also in a new way suits that role-playing nature, because the characters that are your fellow board game players are narrating as you go through, and sometimes they actually switch up, like they commentate on what you're seeing and they'll switch up what you're seeing on screen because they've made a joke about it, let's say. So I like that kind of like breaking its own internal fourth wall as part of the writing. And I like that twist of it. And then like Will Arnett, Wanda Sykes, Andy Samberg, like it's a pretty star-studded cast that as far as like the characters that are playing the board game with you. And they do a great job. I'm really enjoying their performances. You can kind of tell there's some like ad-libbing going on there, them adding their own personalities to it. So the general environment is pretty cool. I'm playing the Clawbringer class, which I'm not too far in yet, but it read to me like normally I automatically pick the magey, you know, witch wizard, whatever, the magical ability class. In this case, I picked Clawbringer, which is more of a melee class because the characteristics read like it was Kratos, because you have like a big you can have like an axe or a hammer and you could throw it and then call it back to you as it hits enemies. Cool. So I'm sure once I progress a little bit more, I'll hit that level. But and if you're watching the video version of this podcast right now, there's a couple like this special ability right there where it's dropping in like a meteor from the top and clashes onto your enemies. I have that right now. So looks like this is my class that we're showing right now. So a lot of like big dramatic melee moments that's like really fun and frenetic that I've been enjoying. In general, the other character classes all seemed interesting too, because like 50% of them have companions, including this one, which I really like. I like character classes with companions. We need more of that in video games.
Oh, yeah.
And then I think the final thing I'll say, at least as far as I've gotten so far, because I'm playing co-op with a friend, so I'm very slow paced, like waiting for him to be available to play so I don't progress too much. But I kind of forgot how fun it is to just constantly be switching up your loot. It's such a dopamine hit every single time. And I feel like extra powerful, even if it's just about the same like damage rate, but just a little bit of a different style of, you know, maybe the guns that when you reload, it actually tosses the gun and redistributes it in your hand. Like just the differentiations of how things feel in your hand can be a lot of fun just in terms of the variety of it. But I'm enjoying it so far.
Okay. So knowing that I also loved Borderlands 2, but couldn't get into Borderlands 3, would you recommend Tiny Tina to me if I'm going to play by myself?
Yeah, I mean, I will say that because you have to play by yourself to a certain point to unlock co-op. You basically hit like a hub city, and that's when, you know, fairly typical in games, that's when you can unlock co-op. So I would say play up until that point at the very least, because I really enjoyed it and I wanted to push through the rest of the night. Were I not, you know, to have had the co-op appointment that I had, but I would have just blasted through and kept playing because I think the narrative layer on top, and even though the overworld is pretty simple, at least right now where I'm at with the game, it's cute enough because you can kind of like decide the direction of where you're going to go next. And there's a couple little hidden things on the overworld map itself too.
Mm-hmm. Cool. I'll check it out.
Yeah.
Justin, you're playing Kirby.
Yeah, I am playing Kirby. It's so charming and cute. And Nintendo, not every recent Nintendo game is like this, but you see, like, I saw it in Luigi's Mansion 3 and in Kirby, where it has this almost like Pixar like quality in its animation and its kind of level of detail and the expressiveness of the characters. And that's what it kind of reminds me of. Kirby, there's so many like tiny little things that make that game feel great, about how he kind of snaps onto these objects in mouthful mode. And also mouthful mode is just super cute to begin with, but like he sort of, you know, will splat into a wall and then like, you know, sort of flatten down like a piece of paper. And then like one of them, my favorite one is he, one mouthful mode is a, Kirby sort of gobbles up this big flashlight, and then he's stretched all out over it, over this, not flashlight, a light bulb. And then you can like sort of turn them on, and the light sort of diffuses through Kirby. And so it feels very cute. It's very filled with personality. It's extremely easy. I'm probably 60% of the way through it. And not only have I never died, but I've never even come close. Like, you know, the boss is like, you know, it's a little bit of a joke from that perspective, but I don't think like, it's just, you can't not have a smile on your face when you're playing, and you're not thinking about the fact that it's easy. It's just like, what sort of silly thing am I going to get to see and experience next? Mm-hmm.
Justin, now when you were a kid, did you ever get a flashlight and hold it up to your hand? Yeah. And you could see your bones. Does Kirby have bones?
He has no bones. Something that's the game has two difficulties. It has Spring Breeze mode, and then it has Wild mode.
I love that it's called Wild.
Wow. Yeah, and like you know,
Kirby
it's
gone wild.
Kirby go. And I think that's really fascinating. Like, if you're remotely a gamer at all, like wild mode is what you want because it's still dead easy. But that binary choice of like, I don't think I've ever played a game before that's like, you know, have a harder mode where you get more challenges or play this breezy mode. I'm like, there's not one of the two that's like, this is the way the game's intended to be played. Like, not having a middle choice, I just thought was really interesting. Like, do you want to play easy or hard? I'm like, what about medium? No, like even on wild mode, the game is dead simple.
It sounds like easy and easier modes.
Yeah, it is easier. The levels are a little bit more linear than I was expecting. The game's trailers did a really good job of making it feel almost like Mario Odyssey, exploring these environments. And it's absolutely not like each game has, like, you're literally like going from point A to point B, and it has an exit, like an end that you're working your way to. And so it's very charming. I feel like I'm playing it the right way, which is like 30 minutes each morning. Like, I'm doing two levels and then starting my work day. And like, that's the way that I'm playing this game. And, you know, I don't think it's like a game of the year contender or anything. Like, if you're a Switch owner that like loved Mario and Zelda and the other big Switch heavy hitters, like, I don't think Kirby is like a must play. But it's very fun. It's very charming. And there's way more personality to kind of Kirby himself than what I was expecting.
Now, maybe. Are you finding clues to who killed all the humans?
What is it with Nintendo and post-apocalypses these days between Zelda and Kirby and Splatoon and not explicitly Mario, but like even Mario Odyssey kind of had those vibes about it a little bit.
Anticipated our times too well.
Yeah. One thing that's annoying about the game is it has all these optional challenges in each mission, and you don't know what they are. They're question marks, and it doesn't kind of fill in until you do the challenge. You know, it'll be like, you know, knock over 4 sandcastles, and you don't know that that's a challenge in that level until you knock over the first one. And I think
it's like the guide for this game, from what I understand.
Yeah. And I think for probably every single level I've gotten like 8 of the 9 hidden Waddle Dees. Like, I've missed one in every single level. And so if I wanted 100% the game, I'd basically have to play through the whole thing twice. Like, I'd have to go back through that linear level again to the 3/4 of the way through point to like get the thing that I didn't know I was supposed to do the first thing around. So I don't like, it's good for replay value, but it's not, that part's not quite doing it for me. But the, you know, overall, it's like every time I put it down, I'm like wishing I could play more.
Nice.
Maybe I'll pick that up because my son likes watching me play Mario Odyssey.
Yeah, he'd love it.
Yeah, I bet he'll be into
something. And I'm playing it. My daughter and I are co-oping through it. Oh, and I should mention the co-op is not very good. It's very much an afterthought of player two keeps getting, the camera focuses on Kirby, and player two just gets warped back to Kirby over and over again and can't pick up any of Kirby's powers. And it's definitely like, you know, a little sibling mode for sure.
Got it.
But
what is player two? Is it a yellow Kirby or something?
You're a Waddle Dee with a spear.
Oh.
And my daughter is 7, and her and I are arguing, like, with the cop, we had to compromise. We're like, we trade off who's Kirby now. Cause I'm like, I don't just want to be Waddle Dee the whole time. And she's like, I don't want to be Waddle Dee either. So we take turns.
It's only fair.
I guess maybe it's good for like younger kids too. If it's a little bit more simplistic, like easier to just drag them along, help them feel like they're participating, but you're really carrying them.
Yep. Yeah.
This episode of Game Scoop is brought to you by NordVPN. As Scoop Nation knows, your Omega Cops have been a little obsessed with a movie called Weekend at Bernie's lately. But as happens too often these days, it is difficult to find it streaming here in the US. That's where NordVPN comes in. With NordVPN, you can switch your virtual location to a more enlightened region where they appreciate the comic delights of Weekend at Bernie's. And it's not just for streaming movies and shows. Switching your virtual location can allow you to save money by purchasing flights, hotels, and subscriptions from other countries at a cheaper price. And you can do all this worry-free as NordVPN threat protection features protect you from viruses, malware, and phishing sites. Best of all, NordVPN costs the price of a cup of coffee a month, and one account can be used on up to 6 devices. To get the best discount on your NordVPN plan, go to nordvpn.com/gamescoop. Our link will also give you 4 extra months on the 2-year plan. There's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. That's nordvpn.com/gamescoop. 1 in 5 Americans has learned a new language on their bucket list, or life backlog, if you will. If that's you, make 2024 the year you finally check it off the list with Babbel. Upgrade your personal skill set in 2024 with Babbel, the science-backed language learning app that actually works. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Its tips and tools are approachable, accessible, rooted in real-life situations, and deliver with conversation-based teaching so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. I have a trip to Mexico coming up, so I've been using Babbel to brush up on my Spanish. The courses are short and sweet, so I can do one whenever I have a few minutes to spare. And the words and phrases it teaches you are designed for practical, real-world use, like ordering at a restaurant or asking for directions. Babbel can even provide you feedback on your pronunciation with its speech recognition tech. And it's not just for Spanish. Babbel includes 14 different language courses, each backed by a 20-day money-back guarantee. Here's a special limited-time deal for Scoop Nation. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, only for our listeners, at babbel.com/gamescoop. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/gamescoop, spelled BABBEL.com/gamescoop. Rules and restrictions may apply. Now let's talk about all new PlayStation Plus. This is a couple days old now, so I'm sure everyone has heard about this already. But now going forward, I think this is planned to launch in June. There's going to be 3 tiers of PlayStation Plus: Essential, Extra, and Premium. They'll go for $10, $15, $18 a month, although you can do a yearly plan. It goes up to $120 for the Premium, so that's twice as expensive as PlayStation Plus is now. All 3 tiers get you those free games every month. The higher tiers get you access to, a Game Pass style subscription of PS5, PS4 games. And then the Premium is what gets you the back catalog games, PS1, 2, 3, and PSP. We don't know what the back catalog games are yet. So I'm curious to know at this point, Sam, will you be upgrading to the extra or premium tiers of PlayStation Plus?
It's really hard to say. I mean, you know the answer to this. It's like without a games list, but I am fascinated that, you know, Sony has a back catalog. They have 90s mm-hmm. games, and mm-hmm. that's really unique. You know, Xbox doesn't have that. Xbox could put collections of third-party games on their streaming service or something like that. That would be a potential option. They've done like that with Xbox Arcade back in the day. Remember, they had like arcade games. You could walk around a little arcade. They could do stuff like that. That'd be interesting. Nintendo has an incredible back catalog. I think inarguably the best back catalog of any system or any console maker. Think about it this way. Their service is only retro games. It's only their back catalog plus the 99s, right? And then Animal Crossing DLC and some DLC stuff. But it's really like that's the focus of it. Like you're getting Banjo-Kazooie and Ocarina of Time and Super Mario World. Like that's the point of it. For a lot of people, I imagine that's the only reason they subscribe. Sony has that opportunity here to have that too. So maybe they'll go for that, but they're making it the premium option, not the foundational option. Mm-hmm. The foundational option is like, you know, some games that are out now and a back catalog of recent games. And then Xbox, as I already mentioned, like not really any retro catalog, except if you count Xbox One. And as I mentioned, maybe some collections, really focused on like only the games that are out right now that like basically you don't have to buy a box for, you don't have to download it. You can just like play all the new games. Like how different are those systems treating retro games and like their audiences? It's kind of amazing. And Sony's like, I think it's like really unappealing unless like it's an amazing back catalog library. Like it has to be, you know, right out the gate, like Symphony of the Night, the Metal Gears, like the things that like people want forever in their collections. Otherwise, it's like,
well, yeah, the games, what games are going to be available is a big question mark. But Sam, you mentioned Symphony of the Night and Metal Gear Solid. Those are relatively easy to play right now on modern consoles.
Totally. That's a really good point.
There are also lots of other games that aren't, you know, like, there's the Squaresoft classic shmup Einhander, which I love. And here's the thing.
First game you brought up when this was announced.
I could not buy a copy of Einhander today for $120. It's like, it's $200 or more. Yeah. So I guess I could pay, it'd be worth it for me if Einhander's included. I'll pay $120 to have access to Einhander for a year. That would be worth it to me. Tina, what was your take?
Kind of similar. I think it's interesting that the general subscription philosophy is something that's being taken on by, you know, a lot of companies increasingly. It was a little bit inspired by like the Netflix model many years ago in like 2014, I think, when PlayStation Plus initiated, and then Game Pass and a couple years after. So I think it's interesting that everybody's kind of coming on board, but still making it a little bit of their own too, and seeing the differentiation in business philosophy around what's going to appeal to people. But I mean, if you just take a look at like our own audience's reactions, it doesn't seem like a lot of people are as thrilled with even the premium tier for the new PlayStation Plus subscription model. Mm-hmm. Mostly because when you inevitably line it up with Xbox's Game Pass, when you see the value of day and date first party accessibility on those platforms, I can understand the business risk. Obviously, it was like a risky move for Xbox to be doing that a couple years ago as well. But look at how it's panned out for them. And then even reputationally, like their subscription numbers are constantly breaking records. It's clearly like become, even though it was initially a risk, it's clearly become a reliable business source for them. And part of their new like metrics for how they're measuring success over there. And I think that shows also reputationally with the way that people talk about Game Pass because of those exclusives that come essentially free as long as you're part of that subscription program. So it's cool to see, like, you know, Sony take a little bit of a different look in terms of emphasizing more of a back catalog with their premium model. But that doesn't seem to have done it for a lot of our audience members, at the very least.
Yeah. Yeah. Without knowing what games are going to be offered, it's almost like, well, it's like, why announce it at this time then? But I think it was actually IGN's Jonathan Dornbush who made the comment that the announcement came just a couple of days before the end of Sony's fiscal year. So this announcement is probably more for investors so that they know that they have got a Game Pass like subscription coming up later on in the year. And then as we get closer to June, I'm sure there'll be a whole event dedicated to revealing, you know, what games people are going to be able to get with their subscription.
We do have summer events coming up. Who knows what's going to be announced?
Yeah. Well, speaking of summer events, since you mentioned it, E3 is not one of them.
No, it's not officially confirmed as of today's recording.
Aww. But, you know, I mean, yeah. Yeah. We've talked about this before. A lot of us old timers still like E3. But it's not like the way it used to be. The way it used to be, there was E3 and then that was it. Summer was a dead zone. But now there's so many events. And even though E3 is not happening this year, we're still heading into a very busy event season.
I have one.
Including IGN's own Summer of Gaming. What's that, Justin?
Yes.
Just I have one thing about the PlayStation stuff. Like, how badly did they screw up the PS3 that those games are still not downloadable and playable natively? You have to stream them. And like, you know, and I don't really like, I'm trying to think like what PS3 exclusive titles do I really like critically want to have downloaded and not streaming. So it's like, I'm mostly just like teasing PlayStation a little bit. I don't think it's like some deal killer or anything, but it is interesting. Like, I downloaded and played an Xbox 360 game recently, and you know, it had cloud saves and, you know, achievements unlocked normally, and it's there in my kind of game stream normally. And I plugged in a player too. Like, everything worked perfectly and flawlessly. The game was up-resed on my 4K TV. But then there seems to be no one left alive that knows how the PlayStation 3 actually works, and like how games for it can exist now in 2022 is just, you know, what was that? That was the Cell processor era, right? Cell
processor, yeah.
Like, yeah. It's so fascinating to me. Like, I kind of want to see, and again, this isn't like, I'm happy to subscribe to this digital subscription service and stream those games. Like, so I'm mostly just kind of teasing here, but I am curious to know, like, I want to know behind the scenes. Like, I want to be on the fly on the wall and like understand how that happened with the PS3.
Yeah.
As far as PS3 exclusives, by the way, I would say Infamous.
Yeah, but do you want to stream it?
Well, I mean, if that's the only way to play it, I suppose.
Yeah.
But that was just like, you know, remembering some PS3 exclusives.
Yeah.
Like I like Resistance too.
Killzone. Yeah. A couple series like that.
I mean, I think Sam, you touched on this, but the PS1, like PlayStation has more history than Xbox does. They just do. So I think that they can get away. I thought it was kind of my gut reaction was like, ooh, it's bold of PlayStation to come in with like a higher price top tier, considering they're a little behind and they're a little late compared to Game Pass, and they're trying to be even more premium and more expensive. But like, once you get back into those 90s games, like, you know, you both touched on it, like some of them can be kind of hard to find, and they're in this different like caliber of video game experience. Like they feel more retro now than, you know, stuff from the 360 generation and on up.
Sure. But it's going to be a hard sell, I think, because like premium is $18 a month. For $3 more than Game Pass, you get some old games.
Yeah.
But for $3 less with Game Pass, you get Starfield Day One.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And I think that depends on your consumption too. Like for us, we're constantly looking forward, like constantly going from new game to new game to new game. So it's really useful from that point of view. Like I don't typically, one game that I do kind of regularly revisit is Portal 2. But I otherwise don't really revisit older games. I kind of like move on from them, mostly because there's just so much new stuff to play at all times. I just don't have the time.
I think part of the like the buy decision people will make for this, because I'm seeing this with Xbox and thinking about it myself, is that like I can say, you know, I would buy a game a month or a game every 2 months or something and like make that calculation. It's like $120 a year. Or whatever the lowest tier is. So is it 90 for the year? The lowest tier?
60
for the lowest tier. So if that gets you like, you know, it's the price of one game. And is there going to be at least one game that I play this year that it includes? Like, then it's like. You know.
But sorry, just to correct you real quick. $100 is the first tier that includes a year is the first tier that includes like a game library. 60 is the existing PlayStation Plus. Like that tier is unchanged.
Yeah, right, so you'd be basically like, is there like a, you know, a game and a half, two games that this is going to cover off on me for this year? And like people actually like are probably going to make that call. And with Xbox, it's really easy because they've already told you like what your calculation can be. It's like there's a couple games you can look forward to, including one of the biggest games this fall, for example. But they did that ahead of the holiday season, right? It was like Halo and Forza last year were like part of Game Pass. Like that's huge.
Yeah,
so, you know, going into this fall, if it's like, well, for sure, you know, God of War and Shadow of the Colossus 2, you know, which is a game completely made up, are going to be on it, then it's like, of course, yeah, like give it to me for $90. I'm saving $30. Or no, I'm saving, you know, games are $70 now, so I'm saving more than that.
Yeah, I'm probably going to subscribe to both. Like I'm subscribed to multiple streaming services. It's fine. And, you know, PlayStation, there's games from that back catalog I'm interested in revisiting. But like where this might start to feel less good or get more complicated is if there's overlap, you know, if there's overlap between the third party games, you know, we know EA has the relationship with Game Pass and those games are part of your Game Pass Ultimate subscription. And if that's similar, like if you're also getting, you know, Burnout and other games like that as part of your PlayStation subscription, and now I'm paying for both, like, man, I don't know. Like it has the potential to get complicated very quickly once you look kind of beyond the first party libraries.
Yeah. The interesting case will be the medium tier, the extra tier of PS Plus. That's just PS5 and PS4 games. Is there just gonna be a lot of overlap between that and Game Pass? Except Game Pass will have the first party exclusives. How will Sony convince people who already have Game Pass to also subscribe to that? And or is there gonna start to be bidding wars behind the scenes for like the Capcom catalog to be only on one or the other platform?
Ubisoft. You know?
Yeah. I mean,
probably. Xbox has the EA Play part of their Game Pass subscription model too. So I imagine so. And I mean we're seeing that sort of bidding war. I mean, I don't know, bidding war assumes that people are bidding on the same company or program. Yeah. So I don't know if it's exactly a bidding war, but we're seeing the same sort of thing with acquisitions as well. Like, you know, they're trying to kind of increase the company value, the software value, which inherently informs what these subscription models are going to be offering people too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's probably going to make it more expensive for Microsoft to buy third-party games for Game Pass. think it's probably a safe
competition
bet. Like there was the leaked, I don't know if it was leaked or announced, but like an amount of the amount of millions of dollars that they pay Dev Guardians of the Galaxy on Game Pass, right? And like that number will probably go up when there's another service also kind of trying to get those games on their service.
Yeah.
If you add up the top tiers from the services right now, it's about $300-$350 for it all. So it's like, that's the price of a Switch, right? It's the price of a new console kind of. And if you're paying that yearly, that's a lot of money and it's a pretty interesting future, right? But for that amount of money, I'd want every damn game available.
Yep.
And that's where like I start getting worried. Like, am I going to be paying $350 a year to get this class of games? Because I have to have them and they're not available anywhere else or whatever. Because retro games are like that for Nintendo, right? You can't really get them anywhere else. Or will I, you know, be able to... and then will I also have to buy a $70 game every once in a while? Like, that's... Mm-hmm. You know, like, it's just not really like that with it's the comparison with Netflix is like I still buy movie tickets sometimes, you know, if movie theaters are open. And so there is that, you know, like it could be like that. But boy, game prices and everything are just they inflate this so much. And you just look at like when can I afford a console again if I'm paying $500 a year for my games?
Oh, man. Like the $350 annual price feels so much worse than like, oh yeah, $15 a month for two services. Fine. I don't want to know that math. Don't tell me that's
bad. Seriously.
It is crazy.
And that is the risk. Like,
I'm buying a console every year.
That's the risk with putting, essentially. And like, that's the risk with not that everybody's putting all their eggs in the subscription basket as consumers, you know, like a lot of people are probably individually buying games as well, or maybe, you know, buying a game sharing with their, you know, their circles, et cetera, and saving that way. But the risk of us becoming dependent on subscription services because we feel like it becomes a catch-all and we get to play everything that becomes available or is popular and, you know, helps expand your library is what if they increase those prices? And, you know, what if they change the subscription models? Like even just recently, Netflix announcing that they might change password share or that they're testing changing password sharing ability got everybody, you know, really incised because they don't want to deal with the implications of like sudden rising costs. Like then it becomes something that was a value that has a specific, you know, more value than the cost that you're putting into it. Suddenly that relationship shifts and you have to reconsider, okay, I do love Netflix, but do I love it so much? Was the reason that I initially loved it, the cost value to me, the fact that I get this much accessible to me, but now I suddenly have like increased prices and costs on all of this stuff.
Yeah.
And the last time we heard from, I believe someone fact checked me, but the last time we heard from Phil Spencer on subscription model costs for Xbox Game Pass, he was saying that, you know, it's still sustainable where it is. So hopefully no, you know, increases for people to worry about there.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely like if you've been a Game Pass subscriber since day one, you've spent $300, $400 on Game Pass. And, you know, it's probably been incredible. You got to play all these Xbox games, all these back catalog of games, like it's fantastic. Right. But Microsoft could say tomorrow, we're shutting down Game Pass, sorry. And, you know, you spent that $400. If you would have just bought Forza and Halo and whatever, you'd still have, you know, 8 video games now in your library that you owned and you could play versus, you know, the service is gone and you didn't own any of it. You were just leasing, you know, the opportunity to play it. Like, I even think about that with like Steam. Like, I have 1,000 Steam games and, you know, Valve's a $1 billion company. Steam's not going anywhere, but like it's very different than the stack of games I have in my closet.
Mm-hmm. And you can technically buy for both PlayStation and Xbox's subscription models. You can buy those games at a discount, but then you got to do the math of all the years that you've been spending on the subscription prices and the games that inevitably you did want to buy it to keep and the discounts you got on it and how that measures up to the years of sunken costs and whatever else. And don't do the math. Your own sanity.
Yeah, don't do the math. We're in the era of buy hard copies of games collectors because they will be in fewer and fewer numbers. You know, the print runs will be less and less.
The Sam era. Yeah.
That's why we have companies like
Warehouse.
So we've got companies like Limited Run Games now. They're printing the most obscure stuff. I'm always surprised when is getting a physical copy now. Snow Brothers. Now Snow Brothers is getting one, Sam.
Really? I watched the trailer for the new Snow Brothers.
A new one or just the old one?
There's a new Snow Brothers.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
It's you know, it's like bad graphics slapped over the original levels and like 30 new ones or something.
Sam, were you disappointed to learn you are not going to be playing Breath of the Wild 2 this year?
I'm of two minds in this, Damon. I was very disappointed because I really, really want to play that game. And I'm not going to roll out the, the old chestnut of like, oh, but they need time to finish it. Well, whatever, you know, but I do like the idea of playing that game next spring. I hope it comes out in the spring because I already know what games are coming out this fall and I want to play all of them. So like, if, you know, I could, you know, the game could come out, I could wait to play it, but I'm never going to do that. I'm just going to miss a bunch of games this fall if Breath of the Wild comes out this fall. Like, that's what I'd prioritize. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's fine. Like, I'd kind of rather have it. But also, here's the problem with that argument, is that when Zelda is delayed, it is delayed into fall, even though they say it's going to be early. They always are like, oh, yeah, we're just going to do it into early next year. That's like, no, sorry, it's out. It's out. It's going to be out in the fall anyway. It just always happens.
Yeah.
Yeah. Except Breath of the Wild.
Yeah, that came out in the spring.
Yep.
That's another thing I'm worried about. They said spring. They said that word. Mm-hmm. Does that original March release date count as spring?
Yeah, they're like, no, we meant spring in the Southern Hemisphere. It's coming out in October.
Well, if you take it according to the equinox, spring has a very specific date that is different every year, but always around mid to end March.
Yeah, so it could still be a March game.
Yeah, good. Definitely. Yep. I, for one, am not surprised whatsoever. I've just been waiting for that delay message, honestly, because I feel like we would have seen more of the game up until then, and everything that we have heard, which has so far been relatively vague, like we've only seen one sitting of gameplay, I believe, and then I guess technically a little bit more alongside this announcement, but yeah, just a sliver, like barely. But what we do know is they're experimenting with a lot of new features. You know, there's supposed to be a lot of sky play in addition to ground play. So I imagine that's complex. So however much time they need to figure out the polish on that stuff sounds good to me.
Yeah.
And then there's the more powerful Switch part of this too, which is like,
true.
Is Zelda always lining up with a system launch now?
Yeah. And maybe they're waiting for, you know, a good bundle.
Justin, you think?
Well, I'll be playing it on Switch anyway, because you will not be able to get that system.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Justin, do you think Breath of the Wild 2 will arrive alongside new hardware from Nintendo?
I mean, it's tough to say. Like, it comes out next spring, you know, supposedly, if it's on schedule. And that's 6 years after the Switch came out. And also 6 years after Breath of the Wild came out. So, you know, you have to kind of believe that the successor to the Switch is imminent. But two kind of points against that are, one, the Switch still sells like crazy. It's never had a price drop. It's still $300. And, you know, they still sell as many of them as they can make. In order for them to have a hardware launch next spring, they would have to announce that hardware this calendar year. And it doesn't feel like they would announce a successor console and lose out on a holiday shopping season for the Switch. So, so I guess that's a long-winded way of saying I don't know.
What if it's a Switch with two screens?
The Switch DS.
That's so stupid. I love it. I like the 6 years thing is crazy. Like, you know, I don't mean this in a pejorative way, but Breath of the Wild 2 is a direct sequel. It's an iterative sequel. Like, it's building on the bones of Breath of the Wild. It's not like burning down Zelda and rebuilding it like Breath of the Wild did. And it's 6 years in development. you know, I think that game was probably deep in like heavy production when COVID hit. I worry about kind of AAA video games in general. Like Suicide Squad is like 8 years in development at Rocksteady.
Oh my God.
And I know I had a couple other examples of games like that are like, you know, similarly, like it just feels like it's getting really, really hard to make a big AAA successful game on time, on budget, on schedule. Like, I don't know how tenable that is. Like, Nintendo's getting away with it because they're making billions of dollars on the Switch. But you can't take 6 years to make sequels like that and run a business that way in general.
It's crazy how extended generations have become. The first five Nintendo consoles are all 5 years apart.
Yep.
All of them, from NES to Super Nintendo to 64 to GameCube to the Wii, are all 5 years apart.
Yeah.
Which is like, now that would be a really short lifespan for a generation, but the generations today don't feel super long to me. I don't know.
No.
It's weird that's the way that's changed.
Well, 3D Metroid Primes are 15 years apart. So.
That's true.
Or more.
So what does Nintendo still have this year that we know of? Splatoon 3? Advance Wars got delayed to sometime.
They have like a slide that they released with like all the logos of like all the stuff that's out this year.
Yeah, what else is coming this year?
Pokemon. This is the Pokemon.
Yeah. Listen.
Wii Sports. Nintendo Switch Sports.
At the end of the month.
Oh, that's right. Nintendo Switch Sports.
Lego, soccer.
Star Wars, the Skywalker Saga.
Well, I was thinking first party stuff, but.
Oh, first party?
Yeah.
Strikers is a game they announced.
That's true. That's true. Yeah.
Nintendo Switch Sports.
Mm-hmm. I'd completely forgotten about that one.
Part of the Wii series.
You guys already said Mario Strikers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Looking at a calendar.
I think they have some announcements to make. And, there has to be a fall lineup. Mm-hmm.
Live Alive. How do you say it again?
Live Alive. Yeah, I'm really excited for that.
Square Enix,
super badass.
I wonder, we're probably due for an announcement for whatever the Mario team's working on.
That's what I was going to say. Mm. I would love the Odyssey follow-up.
Yeah,
You guys already... Go ahead, Justin.
I don't think that team, I may be wrong, I think it's like that Tokyo team. I don't think it like is a Mario team in the way that the Zelda team's the Zelda team, right? Like, the Mario team, I think, also made like Donkey Kong Jungle Beat and some other like innovative games. So, maybe I'm wrong about that. But anyway, like, what a talented group within Nintendo, and excited to find out what they've been working on for 5 years, 4 years.
Yeah. It's so crazy. I think about this a lot with video games. Like, at a place like IGN, like, we create content and publish a lot of content on a daily basis. We like create it and fire out the door and it's done and we move on to the next thing. I just like can't imagine what it would be like to like work on something for 5, 6, 7, 8 years of your life. You're just working on one thing.
Mm-hmm. And then IGN gives it a 6.
Yeah, it's a game. It's a game reviewer. It's like derivative. Yeah, or it's canceled. They're like, I worked on a level for 6 months that was cut from the game.
Yep.
Did we say Xenoblade Chronicles 3? Because that's a fan favorite.
That is a fan favorite. Yeah,
that's a good one.
Yeah,
for sure. I think we said Advance Wars.
Yeah, right. That one. Hopefully, it got delayed indefinitely. Let's check in with the listeners.
Hey, listeners.
Listeners, remember, you can always reach us at the email address gamescoop@ign.com, just like Big Tony style.
What's up?
Big Tony style says, over the weekend, I finally got around to watching 2021's Dune Part 1. I knew going into it that it would end on a cliffhanger, so I had no issues with where things left off. Made me wonder why it isn't explored that often in the video game industry to release games in multiple parts to help shorten development time, given all the delays we see. Might not make business sense for publishers, but it's just a thought. I'm curious what your take would be on this idea. Horizon Forbidden West. What if they release it in 3 parts?
Mm-hmm.
So like splitting the most recent release into 3 parts.
It's working great for Final Fantasy.
I mean, the first part would just be the tutorial, the very long tutorial. Yeah. And that was my point. My first thing that I was thinking too, like, I think there would be a lot of pushback. Like, you remember the original conversation that happened around when DLC became a thing? I think it would be very similar to the kind of narrative, that was happening around like the introduction of that as a new format in games.
I mean, I feel like I feel just as many games do end on like cliffhanger notes as like movies do. Like, it's not super common in either, I would say. But like some do. I don't know.
Like, I didn't finish the first Horizon, but obviously the sequel is set up by that game. So would you, like, Justin, I know you finished it. So
Horizon
would you say
1?
That
no,
was,
I'm, I'm still, I haven't finished Horizon 1. Okay. Yet. I'm in the middle of it.
I did.
Someone here finished one. You finished one.
Yeah.
So yeah, does it like lead into, does it feel like a cliffhanger that leads into? Right where left,
it totally does. There's a cliffhanger and then it has like a kind of like, you know, one of the scenes in the next one is like at the site of the last boss fight where you like, I guess I won't go into it, but yeah.
Right.
It's like directly linked.
Well, because they do have like a big reveal in, because I read a synopsis so that I was a little bit up to speed for 2. But then in 2, they take that big reveal from the end of 1 and kind of play through that. So I guess theoretically, if there's like branches to a story where you have sequels, isn't that kind of the same thing as opposed to Final Fantasy 7 Part 1, Part 2?
Yeah. Well, there is a difference there between like the story just stopping and be like, see you in 5 years versus like, you know, the classic art of like, let's tell a compelling self-contained thing that leaves the door open for more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Telltale was all about the episodic releases. With
yeah, that worked for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, yeah. Well,
you know, it's, you know, what's different about that series as opposed to any other video game, though, is that you could pick up and just, like, start those pretty easily. I would just worry about the riding the bike aspect of games. Like, I suck at games. If I even, like, I was seriously worried, like, I went a weekend without playing Tunic. And I was like, I am leaving this at a really hard place.
That's my exact fear. I do worry about when I come back to Tunic, I'm going to be like, what am I doing?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I've been swapping between Ghostwire and Tiny Tina quite a bit. And the mechanics are so different. And sometimes I forget, like, what's jump again? I've actually tweeted about it in the past for another game where I was swapping off between a few. And I didn't expect that tweet to take off. But I had, like, designers quote tweeting, like, video game designers quote tweeting me being like, this is why we need something more universal, which I think is such an interesting debate. Like, should we have universal programming coded in that way? Obviously some gameplay doesn't lend itself to that way, because maybe you have special, you know, it's obviously like a first person shooter, and a first person shooter is the best way to, like, comparing on a genre level at the very least. But even then you might have special mechanics that wouldn't directly line up. But I think it's interesting, like the comfort that you get with a certain control scheme.
It was totally Assassin's Creed going into Red Dead, where the ride the horse button was punch. In Red Dead.
Yes. And you that's right. I remember that.
Trouble for punching horses in Red Dead.
Yeah.
And you'd be like sidling up to your horse outside a saloon. You punch a horse in the butt, it would kick you across the way and people start shooting at you.
Yeah.
It was really funny.
And also the personal guilt, you know, like that's the hardest part.
Well, the horse
also, there was a similar thing with Ghost of Tsushima, where I kept slashing my horse with my sword, but I don't remember what,
that's right.
What game was causing confusion there.
It might have been The Last of Us 2, I think, came out.
Maybe that was it.
Yeah, with the horse.
The same time.
Yeah, that could have been it,
I mean, it used to be, like, in the early 2000s, it was chaos with control schemes and every, like they're definitely, like, there's not literal standardization now, but, like, you know how to aim down sights in a first-person shooter, and you know, like, grenade is going to be mapped to, like, you know, probably left or right bumper, and that jump, you know, like, we have established this kind of, like, common norms of, like, you know, the jump button, the interact button, the melee button, and, like, when a game deviates from that, that's when you're like, what? Like, it just so, and it used to not be like that. Like, video games, every video game was just chaos, and they would map whatever they wanted any controller button.
Yeah.
Killzone had between R3 to aim down sights or whatever it was. It was crazy.
I can think of
I find that, like, between PlayStation and Xbox too, just the two different controllers, like, there's different standards for each of those. So you're swapping between your consoles, that adds a layer of confusion. Like, I'm playing Tiny Tina on Xbox, but Ghostwire on PlayStation. So the swap definitely catches me off guard here and there, especially when I want to take a screenshot. I suddenly forget and I'm hitting, like, the menu button occasionally.
Yeah.
Yeah. I started an industry lobbying group just now. It's called Universal Horse Button. So universalhorsebutton.com. Let's raise this money. Let's petition.
As important as the jump button. Yeah. Almost as universal as a jump button these days.
I can think of a couple issues with if you split big AAA games into episodes. If we consider Horizon Forbidden West, say the release in three parts, as much as I like that game, like, after I play the first part, you know, there's 1,000 other games to play then, and, like, whenever part two comes around, who knows what I'm going to be playing, or if I'm in the headspace to go back into it. So it may just lose my attention, right?
That reminds me of just straight up, like, not even the gameplay stuff I was talking about, like Netflix series. Like, I'm watching all the Star Trek series right now. Like, I don't remember what happened the last season of Discovery at all.
Dude, I went through the exact same thing last night. I was like, oh, they'll have a previously on, and then they didn't. And I'm like, I don't remember what you're doing or who you are or what anything is anything.
I was like, I know this guy's face. I think he was a main character last season, but he's not part of the crew. So, like, that would be totally, in a game like Horizon, can you imagine, like, the factions in that game and, like, what's going on? Like, 2 hours into the game, I was like, I don't remember who this person was. You know, like, they just were introduced.
Dude, for the life of me, I don't know why TV shows don't bake in previously ons.
I know.
They should do it for every episode, as far as I'm concerned. But at least at the beginning of a season, bake it in. Because, like, sometimes in Netflix, if you can find it buried in, like, the trailers, there might be a recap. Just bake it into the episode.
And then sometimes they're like, they show a character from, like, two seasons ago, like in Sopranos, and you're like, oh, like, is sister's coming back?
The implications.
But the other issue with the episodic big games that would be on the publisher side is Horizon Forbidden West costs, what, $70 on PS5? They split it up in three parts. Say they charge $25 for each one. There's no guarantee that the people are going to pony up for parts two and three. Maybe they play part one. They're like, this isn't really for me. Now they've lost out on that extra $50, right? Mm-hmm. Anyway,
yeah, I think games should be just released early as big buggy messes. It's better for
so me reading the current funny standard, stories about you're video saying.
Games. Yes, exactly.
So things are going just fine then, as they are.
Yeah.
That brings us to video game 20 questions. Our suggestion this week comes from Colin McIsaac in an undisclosed location. Let the questioning begin.
Is this a PlayStation exclusive?
Is this a PlayStation exclusive? No.
That ruined
it. Cool though, right?
Yeah, that was going to be all my
three questions.
I should have started with is it an exclusive, but I wanted to go for the meta.
Yeah, I was on the same page. Did this game come out in the 90s?
Yes.
Cool.
Could this game appear on the PlayStation Plus streaming platform?
No.
Is it a Nintendo game?
No.
Well, why couldn't it appear on the streaming platform then?
Only if it was a Nintendo game, as far as I'm concerned.
Damon, when you answered that question, were you assuming that third-party games could appear on that streaming platform?
Well, yeah.
And that doesn't count as a question.
Yeah, that doesn't count as a question, just to clarify.
But remember,
why couldn't it?
The PlayStation subscription platform is just for PlayStation platforms. Yeah.
Is this an arcade game?
No.
Is this a Sega Genesis game?
No.
What the fuck?
PC?
Yeah.
Yes.
All right, okay. Is it part of a series?
Yes.
Is it?
Okay, so questionable series.
Is it? Well. So what? So PC, there's a billion PC exclusives, but like, but I mean, like, it's probably like, you know, like a Blizzard game or like, you know, one of those computer RPGs or point and click. Like there's only a certain few genres that like they never made their way to console.
Let's go through the genres.
Is this a real time strategy game?
Well, no.
What were you going to say, Sam?
Oh, I was just going to start it wider as like a strategy.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I was going to go point and click. Should I not? Do you want to go that direction?
It's fine.
Is it a point and click game?
That is how you interact with and control the game, but I don't think that's the genre you would put it into. And that's 10.
What does that mean? It means it's like a mouse controlled game?
Maybe
it's like Diablo?
So that sounds to me like a no. Like if it's not considered a point and click experience, like narrative style game.
I think it just means it's an adventure game, but you might not call it that because it's missed.
Right.
It's probably missed.
I mean, that's kind of what I was thinking when I was going in that direction.
I bet missed was... have 3D graphics.
Does Myst have 3D graphics?
Yeah, totally. It's like it'll have like the cyan logo at the beginning was 3D, and then when you move, sometimes it like it'll have like a mechanical bird go like squawk, and it'll like be in 3D.
I don't know though. Like Myst was JPEGs that you were like clicking on. Like it didn't have like mouse look or anything like that.
It had postage stamp size rendering in it.
Okay.
Damon. Hi, David. Oh.
So you want the answer to the question, is it in 3D? Yeah. I don't think so.
All right, so it's still missed.
Yeah, do you play this game in the first person perspective?
Mm-hmm. I don't think, I'm not going to answer. I don't think that applies to this game.
Darn it.
Let's do that. So we avoid any controversy.
Controversy.
What? Maybe it still is a narrative game. But
doesn't apply.
Yeah, like maybe you're seeing the view, but you're not like a human looking through eyeballs into that same view.
Or
like it's a card game.
Yeah.
I mean, it being a 90s game is tough, but like, you know, like text adventures. Mm-hmm. I don't think any of them were still around in the 90s.
Give me a sim.
Yeah, we should still. Yeah, go ahead.
Sims, like Sims or SimCity, something like that.
Could be a simulation game.
Yeah, go that direction. Yeah.
Is this a sim game?
No.
Damon.
Should we go?
Why'd you pick this game? Why did I pick this game? Okay.
What did he say?
He said, "Why did I pick this game?"
Oh, there's no rhyme or reason to it. It's chaos every week.
So it's a Damie game. No, it's a Damie game, maybe.
Yeah.
Not a PC exclusive, probably.
Are you asking, is this a Damie game?
No.
Did you ask that, Sam?
That's fine. You can ask it. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Amy? Yeah, asking.
Okay. Well, I've never played this game, so.
Oh.
That's how I'll answer that one.
What about
definitely a PC game?
What about like Lemmings?
Yeah.
Or like, you know, something weird.
Damon's
like some
played like weird.
I was gonna say, yeah, there's no way.
Yeah.
That would be
like a Lemmings like.
Do we feel like it must be an obscure game then? Or maybe like a not rated highly game?
What was it called? Zambuzis?
The educational game I mentioned, the journey of, I forget it already. It's Zumbinis, but I forget the other part.
Damon chose that because of the meta?
Has anything we said like eliminated
Zumbinis? Is anything relevant?
It's 3D, right?
Yeah. No, I can't remember. I would Google, but I don't want to. Hands off.
Yeah.
We'll reveal it later.
Yeah, it could be, you know. Okay. Where do we go with this?
Could be like Oregon Trail.
And there's versions of Oregon Trail from the 90s, but I think he would go for an earlier one.
Yeah, I think you're right.
That's like, I guess I would call that point and click.
I'm really thrown off by the perspective not mattering. I don't know what to do with that.
Well, because first person would apply to that game because it's a Lemmings-like. So it's like, you are looking at these things. Who are you, though?
Right. And that's like where like strategy would kind of come into play.
That's why it's point and click. So I think we're on the right course here. And I think it could be that game.
Oregon Trail?
No. I think it could be the Bamboozies.
You say it differently every time. I don't think it's that. He wouldn't. No, he wouldn't.
He might.
Have we attempted to say the name of this game yet, Damon?
Yes.
Yeah.
How many more questions we have left?
Six questions left.
It's an educational game, right?
Yeah. So we can ask, is it an educational game?
Yes. Is it an educational game?
Yes. That's 15.
All right.
Do you wear many different hats in this game?
That would be
a Zumbini reference.
I don't know.
It is in the Zumbinis game, so that's relevant.
Okay. He can't answer it because he doesn't know. So
I think we got it. Yeah.
I don't know. What are we going off of? Laughter?
Well, from a screenshot, what would a screenshot show Damon in this? Would it be that do you control multiple characters on screen at once?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's one. Do you control multiple characters, Damon?
Yes.
That's because still be Oregon Trail, though.
It's totally Zumbinis.
Yes. Yeah. Can you die of dysentery in this game?
Are you like, okay, hold on. Do you control multiple creatures? Because Zumbinis aren't humans in Oregon
Trail. We want to make sure we get this right.
Yes.
Yeah.
It is.
Is it Zumbinis? Should we do it?
Yeah,
I can ask. Is this the Jam Bram Bronies? No, I'm just kidding. Go for it, dude.
Is this the Zumbinis game?
Well, hold on. Can I? It's like the Zumbinis game.
Yes, because I think it's like the Legendary Adventure or the Adventures of or something like that. I always forget.
It is Logical Journey of the Zumbinis.
Yes, nice. I love it. Look, here it is.
So no, not 3D.
Hilariously, we were both confused by that, too. Yeah.
It's the educational wonders of the Jambronies.
Yeah. So you do wear, I guess now that I'm remembering, like you do wear some of them have different hats, but then also like you see the little propeller guy. And then, the little springy woman, too, the one with wheels. So they all have different sorts of abilities. And sometimes you have to leave the Zumbinis behind as you're progressing. So you start off with, I forget how many you start off with, but let's say 10, 12, something like that. And then as you go, some of them can't make it past certain barriers. So you leave them behind. And the point is to try to get as many Zumbinis to like the last point to, like, from point A to point B as possible.
Does it have a self-destruct for all the Zumbinis?
No, it's a children's game, Sam.
Well, Lemmings Lemmings does.
Yeah,
self-destruct. It does. Yeah, because that's the best part of the game. You have to leave some lemmings behind because they're part of getting the other lemmings to the end.
Yeah,
and some of them are
leave them behind. Yeah.
Yeah, and so to finish the level or to just nuke the level, you hit a timer and then they all blow up and they blow up parts of the level. It's pretty
funny. Well, this was a happy selection, Damon. That made my day.
I actually saw this as a hit in discussions on GameScoop's Facebook page. And
nice.
That was part of the reason why I chose it. Yeah. And that's why Colin McIsaac suggested it, because you mentioned it last week, Tina.
So nice.
That was the meta this time, Colin, around.
Why did I pick it?
Yeah, see, like, you point and click to control, but I think it's an educational, like, puzzle game, right?
Yeah, I suppose that's how you would codify it most.
And that's why I was saying, Justin, that the viewpoint doesn't really apply to that game.
Sure. Yeah, I guess you're kind of like God, like you play God in that.
It's like
game.
We've gotten into some rough waters. We talk about whether, like, Civilization is a first person game.
Right.
Oh
right.
Yeah, always.
Tina, did you know that there was a successful Kickstarter in 2015 to remake Zumbinis?
Did they end up remaking it?
Yeah.
It's on Steam.
On PC and iOS, yeah.
And did it go over well?
IGN didn't review it.
Did it have good reviews? Well, yeah. So there's no way to know in that case.
Nope.
took 8 years and IGN gave it a 6.
Classic IGN.
Well, that's all the scoops that we have for this week. I can't believe I'm saying this, but I'm looking forward to getting back into Elden Ring later this evening. Thank you, Sam. Thank you, Tina. Thank you, Justin. Thank you to Alan working behind the scenes to make this episode possible. My name is Damon. This is IGN GameScoop. We're out.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it,
Or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Linsky.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz and how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.